today is April 21st this time.
20th.
Okay. And back with Andy Chan for the third and final day of the Pew interview. So actually yesterday we got sidetracked, or maybe I got sidetracked into starting to talk about being a PI before we finished talking about how you got to be a PI.
Oh.
So I wanted to go back. We had pretty much talked about your internship and residency, mm-hmm. but then we didn't talk about your fellowship / postdoc, which you did in San Francisco. So how did you come to end up there?
Okay. So again, based on the people I've been exposed to, being John Atkinson, and actually my thesis committee chairman at that time was Ben Schwartz, who's also a rheumatologist. Mm-hmm. Those two individuals clearly had a significant impact as to the type of physician scientist I had wanted to be. Mm-hmm. I think further compounded by the fact that my mother had lupus, mm-hmm. And I was interested in immunology, mm-hmm. all those things I think contributed to my ultimate decision to do rheumatology. Mm-hmm. Although it's sort of a strange dichotomy, the two subspecialties I had debated about were actually cardiology and rheumatology, which are probably as diametrically opposed in terms of subspecialty that one can do. In the end, I think because I was interested in doing basic science research, also because of the undoubtedly the greater demand in terms of one's time, in terms of clinical responsibilities, if I went to cardiology, I ultimately chose rheumatology. And hence, I did a rheumatology subspecialty. And the selection of, you know, UCSF at that time was primarily, again, asking a variety of individuals where they thought probably the strongest rheumatology subspecialty fellowship programs were. And my need at that point to at least leave Washington University, because I'd been there for 6 years of graduate training and also 3 years of postgraduate training. And after entertaining a variety of different programs, UCSF was the program that I ultimately chose. So I went there in 1989 to begin my clinical fellowship. It was a one-year clinical fellowship, and then began doing lab work in the laboratory of Art Weiss at UCSF, working on T-cell receptor activation. And I was in Art's laboratory for, about 3.5 years before coming back to Washington University in January of 1994.
Now, I don't know whether things have changed since I knew a lot of people going through fellowships, or whether you just had a different experience, but it seemed like fellowships used to be about 3 years, a clinical year and 2 years of research. So you had kind of a long fellowship by that standard.
Right. So that's what the fellowship program is. Uh-huh. Usually it's 1 year clinical work and 2 to 3 years in the laboratory.
I see.
Realistically, I think, and that's the end of your fellowship, but I think most people who want to continue on in science in terms of an academic career undoubtedly will require probably a total of anywhere from 3 to 5 years mm-hmm. of laboratory training. Mm-hmm. So for me, the 3.5 years was probably a little bit on the short end.
Oh, really?
In terms of the general experience. Uh-huh. Again, you think about it, you know, 3.5 years, that means you probably have to start looking for jobs at 2.5 years
right.
In the laboratory, and that doesn't give you a huge amount of time to really get mm-hmm. a sufficient amount of work done. Mm-hmm. Again, I was fortunate to have sort of stepped into a project that worked not immediately, but fairly mm-hmm. quickly. Mm-hmm. So from that standpoint, 3.5 years is probably, by today's standards, when one actually considers the total amount of time, it's probably a little bit on the short end. Mm-hmm. Now, the titles, I mean, what you may in part be referring to is also the titles that people hold. So I consider my entire 3.5 years as part of my fellowship, when in fact, probably on paper, the last 2 years, actually, I think I'm listed as an adjunct assistant professor at University of California, San Francisco.
Oh, really?
Okay. So I still consider that my part of my fellowship, mm-hmm. because responsibility-wise, mm-hmm. my primary responsibility was to do my laboratory work, despite the titles. The mm-hmm. titles permits one to obtain funds for the university, mm-hmm. To get a variety of funds to fund your research. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But in terms of training-wise, it was really in that mode as a postdoctoral fellow.
You had mentioned, I think it was yesterday, that, you know, everyone in that lab went on to become an independent investigator. And this was while we were talking about the quality of the graduate students and postdocs now. And I wonder if you have any ideas about what that was about. I mean, you know, there are many possibilities about why all those people went on to do that, and maybe now they don't, or... Mm-hmm. whatever, but what went on there that created that?
I mean, I think, first of all, the PI of the laboratory, Art Weiss, mm-hmm. it was clearly a very, very accomplished investigator. Mm-hmm. And as such, he was able to attract individuals who also wanted to achieve a certain degree of excellence rather than just seeing a postdoctoral fellowship as a job. Mm-hmm. And hence the individuals that he recruited, whether that be it graduate students or postdocs, went into the laboratory with that goal in mind. Mm-hmm. They weren't going into the laboratory saying, you know, I have to get a PhD. Well, I'll just go into here and spend, you know, my 5 years in the lab here and I'll come out the other end with a PhD. Mm-hmm. The graduate students that were in Art's lab, by and large, were extremely driven in that they wanted to accomplish something, not just necessarily just get a PhD. And it was one, I'm sure, you know, by chance that he had recruited a group of individuals that, by and large, got along with each other extremely well, had very common goals, and who worked well together. So that in itself made the environment better than each one of the individual parts. There were a lot more discussions that I've seen in most other laboratories. So I think in part it was Art, and in part it was the recruitment of a certain set of individuals that just clicked. And then the final thing, I think, is San Francisco. I mean, everybody wants to obviously go to San Francisco at some point in their lives. So I think all three factors created that particular environment for those particular years. Mm-hmm. I mean, once those individuals left the laboratory, obviously the environment of the laboratory changes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, even though Art was in San Francisco, were still constants in that equation. Clearly, it was an unusual circumstance that all those individuals happened to be recruited there in a particular group within a particular time.
Sure. So how'd you like San Francisco?
Well, San Francisco is a wonderful place. when we started there, you know, my wife was a GI fellow.
So she was able to get a fellowship.
Yes,
also.
She was able to, we co-matched in rheumatology mm-hmm. and GI. Mm-hmm. We didn't have kids at the time, so our expenses were by and large just real estate for renting the apartment and paying for the parking space. Those were our two major expenses. We didn't really have any other really expensive vices per se. Mm-hmm. So we lived comfortably on fellow salaries when you had two fellow salaries combined. But it was a wonderful time.
So, when you look at, you know, the whole medical thing is different, obviously, than just going through a PhD program. So here you are, you know, finally at this fellowship / postdoc level. Mm-hmm. How does the path that you took for this period of time compare with just doing a regular postdoc?
Are you asking for, in other words, an MD-PhD versus a PhD
right.
postdoc?
A fellowship versus a postdoc. A subspecialty fellowship.
Oh, I see. A clinical fellowship versus a postdoc.
Mm-hmm. Well, the fellowship is part clinical and part research, right?
Right. But I think the only major difference there, mm-hmm. okay, for a fellowship that includes certain clinical years and certain basic science years. So the clinical years obviously are very different.
Right.
It's basically you're continuing in patient care mm-hmm. and learning about the rheumatology subspecialty. Mm-hmm. But then the research years is pretty much similar. Okay, you participate in the same kinds of journal clubs, seminar series, you do your lab work, and you are measured in the same way as a PhD postdoctoral fellow mm-hmm. who is also doing the postdoctoral mm-hmm. fellowship. The only additional responsibility that usually one has is that you still have one half day clinic per week. So, I mean, those are required for you to be able to get board certification in certain subspecialties. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, the other 4.5 uncommitted days were totally committed to my research. Mm-hmm. So from that standpoint, the other 80% remainder non-clinical time mm-hmm. was basically the same as a postdoctoral fellow.
Okay. Did you have to pull any sort of on-call rotations as the, you know, during mm-hmm. your lab years, you know, for the house staff if they
right.
needed a rheumatologist? At
no. During the second and third years of my fellowship, mm-hmm. or the first, which equate to the first and second years of my laboratory experience, the program is set so that you are spending 90% of your time doing basic science laboratory work. The on-call rotations, at least this particular program, was set up so that the first-year fellows had their full year of clinical work.
Okay.
Now, during the last year that I was at UCSF, because I had this assistant or adjunct assistant professor position with my own grant funds, I did have to attend mm-hmm. on rheumatology mm-hmm. 1 month out of the year. But that's the only additional clinical responsibilities that one had during that time. I think, you know, this is an important thing. This particular concept of protect the time is extremely important.
Mm-hmm.
I was fortunate to have mentors, Art being one of them, who were extremely protective of the physician-scientist mission, of the academic scientist mission. And he, as division chief, also realized that one cannot be spending, you know, X number of additional weeks or months, or be pulled away because somebody happens to be sick mm-hmm. Onto the clinical service, mm-hmm. and that you really have to dedicate your life and your time and your focus onto the basic science research.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not a universal finding. Cross divisions at almost every medical mm-hmm. school in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually has led to certain things that I've developed subsequently here at Washington University, mm-hmm. Which we can come back to and discuss later, which is a physician-scientist training program that tries to ensure that the research mission during the postdoctoral research years are totally protected.
Mm-hmm.
But I was fortunate enough to have the mentors that I have been exposed to realize that and protect me from those other issues during my training time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I was trying to do some mental calculation here on how old you were by the time you finished
ancient.
This.
Ancient.
out about 34 in my head.
That sounds about right.
That sounds
before
about
I took
right.
my first real assistant professor job.
Okay. So how did you end up here?
Back at Washington University. Mm-hmm. I had entertained a couple possibilities. By the time I finished, was that I wanted to be an academic physician. I wanted to be in an institution that valued basic science research, that had strong basic science immunology. And I think as one trains further, one realizes there are less and less number of institutions in the country that would make one that would make it possible. Mm-hmm. And WashU at the time had very, very strong basic science immunology. Mm-hmm. And based on my previous experiences here, I knew that it was extremely supportive of junior faculty. Mm-hmm. The odd thing is that when we left post our clinical training, at that time, it never dawned on me that I would even consider coming back to Washington University.
Oh, really?
But nonetheless, after taking a look at a very, very small number of positions, I ended up deciding that WashU was the right place because of its commitment to junior faculty, its strong basic science immunology, mm-hmm. the respect as well as push and commitment to physician scientists. Mm-hmm. A lot of the outstanding basic sciences that are done at Washington University are actually done in the clinical departments. Mm-hmm. That's not true for many other institutions where most of the basic science research is done in the basic science departments. Mm-hmm. And finally, I had known lots of people here, and the department chairman at that time was my thesis advisor, John Atkinson. Mm-hmm. So it was sort of a very comfortable place, a place where I knew I would be taken care of, and in a place that I knew that I would be given the resources to flourish. And then with the birth of our twins, that also totally changed the way that we, the things that we were looking for in terms of a city. So we had our twins 6 months before we moved. Mm. But we knew we had, by ultrasonography, we knew we had twins already, obviously 6 months previous to that. Mm-hmm. So it was that constellation of resources and observations that made us come back.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, you mentioned the other day that, they have a startup package here that, they invest, $100,000 or so in a new junior faculty member. So what kind of a deal do you get when you come here?
I mean, that's clearly dependent upon who you are, what divisions you go into, and things like that. So, mm-hmm. And inflation clearly has affected that.
Sure.
At the time, in 1994, I think a reasonable startup package probably would have been on the order of somewhere between $300,000 to $400,000 total, exclusive of salary for the PI. And the way, that many, at least I discussed it over in terms of the resources I needed, weren't necessarily in absolute numbers of dollars. It was more of a description of what kinds of resources I needed in terms of equipment, access to equipment, and what kind of support for students' postdoctoral fellows I needed over a certain amount of time. And while all this was going on, all of this was sort of made moot because of my appointment to the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, because that allows me to have a certain number of positions from the institute. So not only do they pay my salary, they pay the salary of certain number of postdocs and certain number of technicians, and there's a supply budget, an equipment budget on an annual basis.
Oh, okay.
So all of that sort of, while we had, gone back and forth a number of times on discussing the resources that would be committed to me mm-hmm. before the Hughes appointment, that went on retrospectively needlessly. The point became moot once that happened.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you ended up with a joint appointment. You have an appointment both in rheumatology, which is, I assume, the Department of Medicine.
That's right.
And also pathology.
That's right.
So how does that work?
So Washington University runs its graduate program through the Division of Biology and Biomedical Sciences. It's one large division, and graduate students that come in enter that division and actually can participate in any program, mm-hmm. whether it be immunology, biophysics, neurosciences, molecular cell biology, etc. And that's actually, I think, one of the beauty of this system, because I think it's very hard for graduate students to know coming, you know, when they're 21, 22 years old, to know exactly what it is they want to do.
Sure.
And hence, this actually gives them opportunities to be able to investigate different avenues of, or different fields of investigation. But for one to have access to the students, one has to be in a basic science program. And Department of Medicine is considered a clinical program at Washington University. But the Department of Pathology is considered a basic science program at Washington University. And actually, a lot of the programmatic interests in immunology are based in the Department of Pathology, which most recently actually has been changed. The name of the department has changed to the Department of Pathology and Immunology. So given those particular types of interests, one always has to decide what kind of joint appointments one requires, and hence I pick pathology of the various departments.
I
mean, most of the departments here, most of the faculty here have joint appointments between medicine and some other department, whether that be Department of Genetics, Department of Cell Biology, Molecular Pharmacology, mm-hmm. it doesn't matter. Because once you have the appointment in basic science departments, the graduate students pretty much can cross mm-hmm. between programs. It's pretty seamless.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the source, or that was the basis for my co-appointments in both departments.
Okay. Well, the thing that occurs to me, though, is that then you have, or maybe you might have double kinds of meetings and double, you know, if you're serving two masters in mm-hmm. a way, do you have twice as much?
WashU is probably a little bit different than many other universities in that, again, one's everyday life is more dictated by the programmatic interests. So while I'm a member of the Department of Medicine, and I'm a member of the Department of Pathology, 99% of my interactions are primarily with people through a variety of departments, but whose research interests are common to mine. So, for example, I know, you know, there are about a zillion business meetings for both the Department of Medicine
yeah.
and Pathology, which I never attend.
You don't go to any of them.
I don't go to any of them.
Okay.
So there are these aspects, mm-hmm. but I mean, the Department of Medicine is very large. Mm-hmm. Department of Medicine probably is somewhere between 250 to 300 faculty members. The medical school, I was just reading the other day, numbers about 1,200.
Wow.
Okay, we actually double the size of the School of Medicine makes up half the size in terms of faculty of the entire Washington University campus. So a lot of the meetings, I mean, I think there are only like 2,200 or 2,400 total faculty in the entire university.
In
the whole campus, main campus and the medical school campus,
wow.
of which half of them are in the School of Medicine. And as such, you know, a lot of the business meetings basically aren't really forums for discussion.
Mm-hmm.
There are forums for announcements.
Right.
Which I can spend my time better off doing things more directly related to my research.
Mm-hmm.
I can read the minutes
mm-hmm.
much faster than I can sit there and, you know, mm-hmm. sit there for an hour and a half sitting through a meeting.
Sure. Okay. Now, you are an associate professor now, right?
Yes.
And do you have tenure?
Yes.
Okay, so tenure is at the associate level here.
Yes.
Okay. it's always curious to me what tenure means if you have to bring in all of your salary. Now, you don't because of the Howard Hughes, but you lose the Howard Hughes.
Right.
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 So what does tenure mean here?
Tenure, I think, in general, is probably an outdated term. Mm-hmm. Okay, tenure, I think, for the medical sciences in particular, is an outdated term. I mean, tenure traditionally has been primarily to protect the faculty so that they have the freedom of expression, mm-hmm. Which I think historically has been especially important in the non-biological sciences or non-science fields, like humanities. Because obviously somebody may be expressing a point of view that may be contrary to whatever the in-fad view is of the university. Mm-hmm. So tenure at the medical center basically means that, there are a number of criteria, all of which boil down to one, have you been able to establish an independent research program? Has that research program resulted in advances as measured by publications and international reputation? And third, has one been able to obtain funding for your research program? Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there are a number of other factors that can factor into it, like service to the university, teaching responsibilities, and contribution to the community. So it is, the way I've always felt about it, it's one of those things that one absolutely has to have, because if you don't get tenured, then you have to leave the university. Mm-hmm. But having tenure, to me, actually doesn't mean a whole lot after one gets it. Because you're exactly right. You still have to be funded, and you're still going to be judged in terms of your accomplished scientific accomplishments. And I use this great quote, and I forget exactly where it came from, and that is, you're only as good as your last experiment. So from the standpoint of longevity and tenure, I don't think tenure issue becomes... is any major factor. Mm-hmm. It is obviously a major thing when you're an assistant professor, because you know you have to get it. Mm-hmm. But if you are a well-accomplished individual, there's no doubt that you should be able to get tenure. Mm-hmm. So if one is looking to achieve and attain a certain degree of excellence, and if you're not able to achieve that degree of excellence, then it's time to move on to do something else, then the decision of tenure isn't such a major stage or major issue that affects one's life. Mm-hmm. In the future, I think there was probably undoubtedly will be a time where tenure is just gotten rid of.
Gone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, many institutions now actually go on 3 to 5 year rotating contracts. Mm-hmm. Again, with funding issues, scholarship issues, mm-hmm. contributing to the decision of renewal or non-renewal. Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess that's the way most people in the world live. They either do a good job
right.
or they're gone, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Okay. I mean, many of the universities actually have gone to a salary system that basically does the same thing. Mm-hmm. So many universities, this one included, have gone to these salary scales, which they call the XYZ at this particular university. Mm-hmm. So X is basically a base salary, mm-hmm. which is usually pretty low, which would be the salary that you're guaranteed even if you lost all your funding and you're tenured. The Y component usually is the component basically between X and Y is actually a total of most people's salaries right now. And hence, what the university then is able to guarantee themselves is that all of a sudden they won't have a faculty that's not funded, but they're still paying them very high salaries. The Z component is predominantly for more clinically based individuals, is actually a bonus. Mm. So what will happen is that if you lose all your funding, all of a sudden you will then only draw your X salary. And most people won't tolerate being paid an X salary for indefinitely.
Mm-hmm. A lot of
that,
places...
That, in essence, gets rid of tenure.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, a lot of places, though, if you lose your funding, they'll fill the gap for you for a brief period of time until you can get funding. Mm-hmm. Do they do that here at all?
That is a very... they will. And, you know, the usual variable is how long that period is.
Yeah, sure.
As an MD-PhD, the one thing that they can always do is give you more clinical responsibilities. Mm-hmm. So you can always usually make up the difference by mm-hmm. doing more clinical work. Mm-hmm. But then that basically is saying you're going to give up your laboratory-based research operation.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, let's go back to all of your PI responsibilities we left off yesterday. Mm-hmm. And we had covered quite a few things, but we didn't get to the writing of papers because of time constraints. And obviously that's a major component of your work. Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about the writing process for you mm-hmm. or your lab.
Mm-hmm. The writing process really is dependent upon the project. Mm-hmm. Okay, there are certain projects that are extremely competitive, in which the paper has to be written in 48 hours. And in those situations, I take an extremely active role in writing the mm-hmm. paper, because the paper has to be sent in, mm-hmm. Primarily because of competition reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And in other cases, you know, most other cases, we actually have quite a bit of time.
Mm-hmm.
So usually the way I go about doing this is that, you know, the postdoc or the graduate student and I sit down, we actually outline what all the figures are first. And we actually have the data hopefully sitting in front of us, knowing where the data, what missing pieces of data still need to be completed. And then I tell the student or postdoc to go ahead and start writing the paper in whichever order they want. And then I say, okay, I expect a rough draft in 2 weeks. Or if they just want to write a section of it, I'll tell them, you know, I expect a rough draft in a week.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll give me a rough draft, and I will work on it, and I'll give it back to them.
By working on it, you rewrite, or you make suggestions to them to rewrite?
I will actually rewrite certain sections of it by hand mm-hmm. and give it back to them.
Mm-hmm.
It just depends also, depends on how far along they are. If right. they're really stuck, mm-hmm. as in they have nothing on paper,
mm-hmm.
then we can discuss, well, you know, how do you think you're actually going to ordering it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what are the major points that you mm-hmm. want to write?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, usually if you have the figures in front of you, writing the results is very straightforward. The introduction, I could even dictate if I had to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it would take me 30 minutes to dictate mm-hmm. the introduction. But nonetheless, it's important for the student or postdoc to go through that process.
Sure.
So I have varying starting points.
Mm-hmm.
My initial starting point is always a blank piece of paper. I just say, go and write.
Mm-hmm.
But here are the figures. This is the order.
Mm-hmm.
But even, you know, introduction, in terms of the introduction, you need to be able to order it in a very logical way. And in some time, you know, most of the time, you're trying to tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to be able to set the story up
mm-hmm.
so that the readers, or in particular the reviewers, will think this is an important problem
mm-hmm.
and understand where it is, how you were led to mm-hmm. do this line of experimentation. So if they come back and they're stuck, then I'll try to order it by paragraphs for them as to what are the major points.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the hardest one is usually the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Because there actually requires the greatest amount of thought.
Mm-hmm.
And usually you've already done the experiments, you know why you did them,
mm-hmm.
you know how they turned out.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, the first paragraph of the discussion is straightforward, usually summarize your results. But then that's where the most difficult part, I think, and yet the most intriguing part and challenging part about writing a paper is. What are the implications of your data? Why is this important? Mm-hmm. How do you relate this to the present literature? And that usually takes the most time. But nonetheless, the student or postdoc writes the paper, they give it back to me, I'll rework, you know, sections by hand. Mm-hmm. And I rework the section. I mean, it would be much easier for me just to write it from fresh. Okay, just write it in the computer. But it's important, I think, for me to write it by hand, because usually I drop down the notes of why certain sections mm-hmm. are wrong mm-hmm. or shouldn't be where they are. Mm-hmm. And then the student in particular will have an idea as to what they can compare. What did they write and what did I write? Mm-hmm. And then they'll at least get a certain understanding of why or the style in which I'm writing. And it's a learning process. I mean, it takes me a long time to write a paper unless, you know, there's certain time issues. And we go through usually easily 20 drafts of each paper.
Wow.
Especially in terms of the discussion. Mm-hmm. And then ultimately something comes out. Some product comes out.
Okay. But you can do this by yourself in 48 hours if you have to.
Well, it depends on the paper. There are certain papers, you know, you publish in Science and Nature, the papers are extremely short. And in many ways, those are the most competitive time-wise. Yeah. So if I can only write 2,000 words, mm-hmm. there's not a lot I can write, mm-hmm. okay? But it has to be written in an extremely concise manner.
Right.
So there I can easily write the first draft and basically work on it over the next 24 to 48 hours to be able to come out with some reasonable product.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we're going to hit this business of competition in a little while. What about the things that your techs are doing? Because, you know, the postdocs and the students have to learn how to write papers.
Mm-hmm.
But the projects that the techs work on, do you write those, or do you encourage the techs to write?
No, I actually, well, the techs actually, my technicians actually, you work on the various aspects of certain projects. So a lot of their projects are just crazy ideas that we begin with. Mm-hmm. Okay, so they're just going to see if it works. If it looks like it works, then usually the project, many times, not always, but many times, are handed off to postdocs and graduate students to continue. Mm-hmm. Because the postdocs and graduate students usually work more hours in general. Mm-hmm. Okay, and they can probably get the work done faster, and they're the ones that need the projects. Mm-hmm. There are a few projects where the technicians work on that are just basically bread and butter projects. And those, I end up writing the papers. I mean, the other thing is that, you know, I actually end up writing probably a lot of the papers in general, because a lot of the postdocs we have, English is not their first language, mm-hmm. In which case you do the bulk of the writing mm-hmm. anyway. Mm-hmm. So the technicians in my laboratory don't write the papers. Mm-hmm. They play an active part in each project. In the end, I end up writing those papers.
Okay. Well, another thing that eats up time is administrative responsibilities. And how much time do you spend? Well, I think this probably is a good time to talk about the physician scientist training program. Mm-hmm. It probably fits under that. But
sure. In
general, before we go there, how much of your time is eaten up by?
What do you define as administrative things, like ordering stuff in the laboratory, management issues in the laboratory?
No, I was thinking more in terms of committees, meetings, mm-hmm. Organizational things. And I know you are, I don't know if this qualifies as administrative, but I know you're a contributing editor to the Journal of Immunology, mm-hmm. and you review papers.
Right. So I'll classify through different things. Okay, there's one which is what I call service duties to the scientific community. Okay, and these will be editorial issues, ad hoc reviewers reviewing manuscripts. And there, I try not to do that during the time I'm actually at work. So actually, most of that I do at home. Mm-hmm. Okay, I just bring the manuscripts or whatever other relevant papers, uh-huh. and I do it at home. And probably I have usually 1 to 2 manuscripts a week. I'm also on study section. So in total, I would say probably that may amount to about 5% of my time. But again, I try not to do it while I'm here. Because primarily when I'm here, I want to basically interact with other individuals that are here, whether that be in my lab or out of my laboratory. And then there are obviously committees that I have to serve while I'm here. But I've been pretty fortunate and pretty selective in picking and choosing the committees that I want to serve on. So there are actually very few committees I actually serve on. So I serve in the steering committee in the program of immunology, which is the steering committee to drive that determines policy for the graduate program. I serve in the admissions committee for the immunology, for the program of immunology. I run the physician scientist training program. I'm also co-director of the of another program called the Four Schools Program for the medical students research program. Mm-hmm. But each one of those in and of themselves probably don't take up probably more than 1 or 2% of my time.
Really?
Okay, so for example, steering committee may account for a whole 5 hours a year.
Oh, that's okay. Not too bad.
I have to sit, you know, I have to be on the faculty committee to give preliminary examinations, oral preliminary examinations. I have to sit on thesis committees. Mm-hmm. So all in all, those I see as things I should be doing anyway, mm-hmm. as part of the educational process. Mm-hmm. I don't feel those necessarily are burdens. Mm-hmm. Those are part of my responsibilities as a PI. And so I actively participate in them. Probably that may amount to another, maybe 40 or 50 hours a year. Mm-hmm. So when you add all the hours up, they probably don't amount to a huge amount of time commitment for my part.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me a little bit about this physician scientist training program.
So the program is designed to provide infrastructure for people who are interested in academic science, coming out of with an MD-PhD degrees or MDs with an extraordinary amount of research experience, and to guide them through the clinical training portion and ultimately back into the laboratory. What we have observed, and has also been in my experience, in my observations, that a lot of the times the major obstacle for people to coming back into academic medicine occurs during that period of time.
During
the residency and clinical fellowship. Because what happens is that you go off basically into a different world where 95% of your colleagues are not going to do academic science or be an academic physician. So you get distracted by a number of other issues that are not probably helpful or condone a career in academic science. Mm-hmm. So the idea of this program was to provide mentorship and an infrastructure to guide these individuals during this particular period. So when we accept an individual, they come into the program as an intern.
Mm-hmm. And actually, let me turn the tape over.
Sure.